glad to see you guys are putting him back to work. Anything else you need, just make sure you go to him. He's good, but splitting firewood, house painting. I've seen him do a dish or two, so make sure you get him going there. I'd also like to thank Reggie and Sandra for being here. Over the last probably 15 years, I feel like I have seen them more than I have seen my family. When they retired, they took it serious, and they're really maximizing that time on the road, so that's exciting to see. Hopefully I can do the same at some point in the future. I'd like to piggyback on what Mike was talking about, situations in different parts of the world. You know, one of the things that's important for us to understand is to be self-aware, to be aware of what's going on around us. Because as time goes on, things change. There's different tactics that are taken. You know, what's going on in Venezuela, what's going on in Chile, you know, it's different from what's happened in the past, different revolutions, and the tactics tend to change from time to time. And it ties in with what I'm talking about here today. I was reading an article not that long ago about a situation in Pakistan. And one of the problems that they're having in Pakistan is that in their culture, children do not have the same rights as adults. Now in this country, you know, with the issues that we have with abortion and all of that, we typically don't think about our children having this rights, but once a child is born in this nation, they have rights. They are equal citizens to adults. In Pakistan, that's not the case. They are not equal citizens. So when there's something that happens to children, the police seem to just not care. In this article that I was reading, it talked about a story of a husband and wife whose child was lost. They go to the police department. They beg and plead with the police department to help them find their child. When the police do nothing, after some time, they go searching for their child. They find the 10-year-old in a garbage pile after being raped and murdered. In 2018, in the first 6 months, 57 children were raped and murdered in Pakistan. And of all of those cases, the police did nothing. Most of the situations, the parents had to actually find the children, then go to the police. And of the 57 cases, only a few of them ever went to only a few of them were ever prosecuted. They went after whoever committed these crimes. When I read that article, we look around at things in Chile, in Venezuela, people disregarding the law, doing whatever they want. There's one word that comes to my mind. That word is evil. When I read those articles about a mother and a father having to dig their child out of a garbage heap after being raped and murdered, evil is the only thing I can think of. The problem is, today, the very definition of evil is being questioned. And this is one of those things that we have to be self-aware of and understand what's going on. Evil is defined currently as profoundly immoral and wicked. But this understanding is being questioned at the highest levels of education in this country and around the world. I'd like to read to you a quote. This is from Stanford University Encyclopedia of Philosophy in a paper titled The Concept of Evil from 2018. In opening, it says, "Should we use the term evil in moral, political, and legal discourse and thinking, or is evil an outdated or empty concept which should be abandoned?" In the article, they go on to explain the concept of evil is an outdated concept, and that evil is something that was self-created by us, and it's something that we should look at doing away with. Today, what I'd like to do is briefly examine four questions about evil. Does it exist? Why does it exist? Where does it exist? And will it always exist? Does evil exist? So to you and I, this sounds like a foolish question. You know, if I were to ask everyone in this room, do you believe that evil exists? I don't think anyone in here would say, no, Matt, clearly evil is not a real thing. But depending on your worldview, the question is not so easy. The question is being asked because depending on your worldview, evil may or may not exist. For centuries, by and large, the accepted belief of almost every society has been one of a creator, some type of God being, or multitudes of gods. But today, that's all going away. The last 150, 200 years, the concept of some outside force outside of you and I, some type of deity, is rapidly declining. There's an old argument, and I'll go through this argument. God is all-powerful, so he would destroy evil and prevent suffering. God is good, so he would want to destroy evil and suffering. Evil like suffering exists, so a good and all-powerful God does not exist. This is a line of reasoning that has been argued for the last 200 years. I'll give you an example of a story in my own life. I had a friend of mine worked with for years. He and I were relatively close. He was an atheist. So we would debate back and forth, off and on, all in good gesture. No, you know, we never came to punches, nothing like that. We would debate with each other. We had this lady whose grandchild was diagnosed with some type of cancer and died at 5 years old. The day we got the news that the five-year-old had passed away, the gentleman comes into my office, tears in his eyes, and says, "How can you believe in a God that would allow that to happen to a five-year-old kid? That kid was innocent." In the midst of the worst trials and the worst pain and the worst suffering in this world, it's not uncommon for us to have that thought. And that thought has spawned into the belief that because that suffering and evil exists, God does not exist. He would not allow it. And we see, I'm not going to have you turn there, in Job 30, if you want to write it down, Job 30 verse 20, Job says, "I cry out to you, but you do not answer me." Just as an aside here for a moment, you know, we as Christians should understand that approach. We should understand that line of reasoning. Because you and I, as Reggie pointed out, we understand what Christ is doing. We understand the plan of salvation. We understand that suffering is part of the process in changing us into making us sons and daughters of God. But for those who do not understand that, it's very confusing to think of, well, you're proposing that there's this all-loving, all-powerful God, yet 57 children in the first 6 months were raped and murdered. Where is that God of yours? We should understand that and be empathetic to that thought process, because that's a very easy thought process to come to when you see those things. But going back, if evil exists, then God cannot. Christian philosophers over the last 4 or 5 years have kind of turned that story around. People far smarter than me, guys like Ravi Zacharias, and maybe you've heard some of these things, they've argued it in an opposite direction. The argument goes like this. If there's evil, well, there must be good, because evil and good coexist. And most people will admit, okay, well, if there's evil, then there's good. Well, if there's good and evil, then there has to be something to differentiate the difference between good and evil. And now we have moral law. Something has to define the difference between good and evil. And philosophers have come to the point, will say, yep, I'll agree with you. There has to be a moral law to define good and evil. Well, if there has to be moral law, then there has to be a moral lawgiver. And that's where people have problems. When you get to the point of moral lawgiver, they go, wait, that's the one I can't agree with you on. Can't agree that there's someone defining moral law outside of mankind. To Mike's point, you know, people argue and say, well, mankind themselves can dictate moral law, but our history has proven time and time again we simply cannot. So what happens is that they have rejected a moral lawgiver, they reject a moral law, they've rejected good, and now we're at a place where philosophers today have rejected evil. I'm going to read to you a quote from Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins is a famed atheist philosopher in his book, River Out of Eden, A Darwinian View of Life. Richard writes, "In a universe of electrons and selfish genes, blind physical forces and genetic replication, some people are going to get hurt. Other people are going to get lucky. And you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe that we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at the bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, no good, nothing but pitiless indifferences." Richard Dawkins argues that at the base of life there is no such thing as good or evil, no purpose, nothing but pitiless indifferences. Richard Dawkins is one of the famous philosophers in the U.S. and overseas, and lectures at every major university that you and I could think of. If we follow atheism and evolution till its full extent, you have no choice but to come to this line of thinking. If you fully believe that we were not created, that we were just happenstance, when you take that all the way out, you have to come to the place where good and evil simply do not exist. If a cat kills a dog, it's not evil. It's just doing what it does. I'll read you another quote. I promise we'll get to some scriptures here in a moment. This is from Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche was a famous German philosopher who wrote in the late 1800s. Nietzsche wrote a book called Beyond Good and Evil. That book was read by Hitler. Hitler then shared that book with all of his allies. The communist movement in Russia quoted this book many times. The Chinese Revolution quoted this book many times. This is Friedrich Nietzsche's writings here, and I'll quote to you from Beyond Good and Evil. "We believe that severity, violence, slavery, danger in the streets and in the heart, secrecy, stoicism, the tempter's art, and devilry of every kind, that everything wicked, terrible, tyrannical, predatory, and serpentine in man serves as well for the evolution of the human species and its opposites." In other words, Nietzsche wrote, "Suffering is good because it weeds out the weak." Since he wrote that book in the late 1800s, in the 20th century, 20 million people died in wars alone. Most of which, those wars were started by people who believed Nietzsche's work. Richard Dawkins, it's pitiless indifferences. There's no good, there's no evil. Nietzsche saying, well, good and evil, okay, good evil is good because it helps weed out the weak. Turn over for our first scripture. We'll look at Isaiah 5 and verse 20. You don't have to turn there if you'd like. I don't like, but Isaiah 5 and verse 20 says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil." Many times I've looked at this scripture and I've thought about it in the process of myself. You know, you do something wrong and you make excuses, right? You go, I sinned, but it was for a good cause. But over the last 150 years, we're seeing that played out on a global scale. And people who call evil good and justify the killing of millions. Let's go back to that story from Pakistan in 2018. 57 children raped and murdered. Are we willing to go to that parent and say, this is just a pitiless indifference? Are we willing to stand in front of that parent and say, this is good for you, it's going to make you stronger? That kid was weak. It comes down to whether or not we can accept that worldview. It comes down to whether or not we can accept a creator who has created moral law and has defined good and evil, or are we willing to say, it just is what it is. In that worldview, love, hope, faith cannot exist. It cannot exist in that worldview because there is no purpose. It seems very, basic for us to ask the question, does evil exist? But in universities across this world, they are teaching that it truly does not exist. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to just assume that all of us have the same worldview and we believe in a creator and thus moral law, thus good and evil. If for some reason you do not believe in a creator, go talk to Jesse. He got his arm back. He'll straighten you out. Okay? Just want to make sure he's got work to do. Why does it exist? It's very easy for us to come to the conclusion that evil exists. We see it in the world around us. We see it in history. We see it in the scriptures. But why does it exist? It becomes a bigger question. In order for us to answer it, we're going to step back. And we're going to reapproach this question from a different perspective. Now, we're going to get some audience participation here. Okay? If I'm going to ask you to describe in one word the character of God, one word that defines who and what God is, what's that word?
Love.
There we go. I love having audience participation because you never know when someone's going to say, omnipotent. And then I have to fumble around. But we're all on the same page. We got this. Love. Love is the singular defining word for what and who God is. Probably the most famous scripture in the Bible, John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. You see that everywhere. You know, you see Tim Tebow would write it on his face, right? Let's go to 1 John 3:16. 1 John 3:16. This is important for us to understand. John writing here, 1 John 3:16. By this we know love, because he laid down his life for us. By this we know love. The Bible tells us that we understand what love is because of what he did for us. Because he laid down his life for us. The act of the cross, what happened that day, defines for us what love is. What's he doing? What was that point for? Why did he die? He died because we made the choice. Adam made the choice in Genesis. I'm going to take of that tree of good and evil. We understand what love is because he laid down his life for us. That's important for us to understand. It defines who he is and defines love for us. Now, I'm trying to get you guys to follow me along on this one. I'm going to make sure that I try to explain this the right way. It makes total sense in my head, but sometimes it doesn't come out the right way. God as creator had four possibilities. He could have not created the world. He could have created an amoral world, meaning that there is no such thing as good and evil. We're just existing. This is an amoral lecture. Can't be good or evil, right? He could have created a world where there's only good, where the only thought that any of us ever have is good. Or he creates a world where the possibility of good and evil exists. It's only in the fourth one that we have the capacity for love. If he doesn't create a world, love doesn't exist. If he creates an amoral world where no one's thinking, no one's using reason, it's just a bunch of wood, it's a microphone, there's nothing to love. There's no thought process, there's no emotion. In a world where only good exists, we're all robots. We're just programmed to make the right decision every single time. It's only in a world where good and evil exist that we have the capacity for love. Because it's only in that world where the option of choice exists. And love is a choice. Love is a choice. Let's try to illustrate that over in Corinthians. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. The Bible is very good at helping us define what love is. So we'll look at those and we'll let the Bible do that for us in 1 Corinthians. The love chapter, we all know it, 1 Corinthians 13. We'll pick up the story in verse 4. It says, love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself. It's not puffed up. It does not behave rudely. It does not seek its own. It's not provoked. Thinks no evil. does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, and endures all things. When we look at this list, you will notice that there are opposites to all of these things. It's not provoked. There's a choice to not be provoked. You're making the choice to not be provoked. Love doesn't think evil. Again, there is a choice that happens in that process. You can choose to think evil or you can choose not to. You can choose to hope or you can choose not to. You can choose to believe all things or you can choose not to. Love, at its base, is a choice. It is a choice. And we're going to illustrate that in two things. Two things, I won't go for the scriptures for this, but two things that are indisputable. Number one, God freely chose to create us. We can go from Genesis to Revelation. We can look at any philosopher, and nowhere will you ever find that God was forced to create us, or had to create us, or needed to create us. It was His choice to create us. It was His choice to express His love in creating us and making us sons and daughters as part of His family. At no point did He have to do this. He freely chose to do that. And in doing so, helps us to find love and show His love for us. He loved us before we were even created. Two, Christ freely chose to lay down His life. God the Father freely chose to create us, and Christ freely chose to lay down His life. This one we'll go over to John 10, because I think this is an important thing for people in the church to understand and know. John 10, look at verse 17. Christ speaking, He says, "Therefore my Father loves me, because I lay down my life, that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of myself." There's this thought process in the background of Christianity that in the beginning, the Father and the Son rolled some dice to figure out who was going to be submissive and who was going to come down and die. Christ is very clear here. He says, "I lay it down of my own." No one forced Him to do that. He did that to help define love for us. 1 John 3:16, we know what love is because He laid down His life for us. And here Christ is saying, no one made me do this. No one is compelling me to do this. I'm doing it of my own. Love is a choice, and it's fully illustrated by God creating us and Christ dying for us. God gives us also then the ability to choose. And in doing so, it's only inevitable that people are going to choose the opposite of God. Let's go back to that choice for a moment. Let's go back to Genesis. We'll start over in Genesis 2. Genesis 2, we'll start in verse 15. It says, "Then the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. And the Lord commanded the man, saying, 'Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. For in that day that you eat it, you shall surely die.'" Let's think about this for a moment. If God didn't want them to eat of the tree, He could have simply not put it there. We have this idea of the fall of man that God was off somewhere doing something else. He was fully aware. He knew what was happening. He saw what happened. He had already known what was going to happen. Remember Revelation 13 and verse 8, it says, "Christ was slain from the foundation of the world." The word there, world, in Revelation 13 is cosmos. It's the Greek word for everything, for the entire universe. There's different words for world. There's different words for ages. But the Greek word used there is, "He's slain from the beginning of it all." Before any matter even started, before the world was created, the plan of salvation was in place. They knew what was going to happen. He gave us the choice. He had to give us the choice. Because in order for us to love Him, we have to choose. We have to have a choice. Now I'm going to ask a thought-provoking statement, and we'll let you guys think about this, and we'll come back to it next year. Okay, you ready for this one? Did Adam and Eve fully understand what love was before they fell? Could they fully understand what love was? Because before they fell, they had no concept of death, no concept of consequences, no concept of Christ having to sacrifice Himself. Something just to think about. Evil exists because in order for us to love God, we need to have a choice. In order for us to have a choice, we need free will. In order for us to have free will, we need to have the capacity to choose the opposite of God. Evil exists. Point three, where does it exist? We've talked about that it exists. We've talked about why it exists. What about where does it exist? I'm going to read to you a quote. This is from Luke Russell. He's a lecturer of philosophy for the University of Sydney. 2014, Luke wrote, "Once someone has become an evil person, he or she is a moral write-off. That's why philosophers are skeptical of the idea that any actual person is evil. If everyone can be redeemed and made good, then no one can truly be evil." Luke Russell is arguing that people can't be evil. He's arguing that if you're evil, then you can't be redeemed. And if we believe that we can be redeemed, then we were never evil in the first place. The problem is that people look at evil in one way. They don't understand that evil exists in two places. We can boil it down to two places. Evil exists outside of the body, and evil exists inside of the body. Now, if you say evil exists in chili, I'm going to say evil exists outside of the body. If you're going to say I have a nagging kidney stone, that's evil inside of the body. Okay, so we're going to boil it down to those two places, outside of the body, inside of the body. So let's look at each of those individually. Because to understand where it exists, to understand why it exists, to understand how to overcome it, we first have to understand where it is. So outside of the body, let's turn over to Ephesians 6. Ephesians 6, we'll pick up in verse 12. Ephesians 6, verse 12, Paul writing here, he says, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand." Paul makes it very clear here that we are dealing with things outside of us. We are fighting a spiritual battle against wickedness and evil that exist outside of you and I. There's no question that who we are fighting is not always ourselves. There is an outside influence that we have to deal with and have to address. I want to look at something here to that point that I find very interesting in Luke. We'll look at Luke verse 22. It's a very common story. Luke 22 and we'll pick up in verse 31. "And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, indeed Satan has asked for you that he may sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith should not fail. And when you have returned to me, strengthen your brethren." Now we typically read this section and we apply it to Simon. That's who we apply it to. And that's a story for Simon. Satan asked to sift Simon, and God prayed for him. Christ prayed for him. The problem is that that's a terrible translation. Because both times the word "you" is used is different. The first one, the word is hymas, H-Y-M-A-S, and it's plural. It's plural. What Christ actually says here, "Simon, Simon, Satan has asked for all of you." We're in the South. I can say y'all. Satan has asked for y'all. It's plural. Satan has asked to sift all of us, all of God's people. It's not until we get back when he says, "But I have prayed for you," now he switches. That's the singular. The Greek word there is S-O-U. It's the singular. I've prayed for you, Simon, so that when you come around, you can strengthen your brother. And that's what he did all through the New Testament, all through Acts. He's teaching us and strengthening us and trying to help us to understand. But when Satan asks to sift, he doesn't ask just for Simon. He asks for all of us. If you don't see that, if we just read that in English, you just miss it. Satan's asking for you. But it's plural and then the singular. Couple that with Revelation 12, that he's accusing us day and night. Not only is he asked to sift us, but he's accusing us over and over again. He's watching us. He's making accusations that are sometimes true and sometimes false. That's what he's doing. That evil exists outside of us. We're not doing those things. We're not sifting ourselves. We're not accusing ourselves. That evil exists outside of the body. Here's the problem, though. If we only look at this as evil existing outside of the body, we will forever have a scapegoat. We will forever have the ability to say, it wasn't me. It was the outside influence. It was Satan who did that. I didn't do that. That was put on me. I was tricked. I didn't do that. Remember when in the garden when they fell, and God goes to Eve first and says, or goes to Adam first and says, "Adam, what did you do?" Adam took this approach. "Wasn't me, it was her." And the woman said, "Wasn't me, it was Satan." The funny thing about that is that he punished all three of them. They were not allowed to use the excuse it existed outside of the body. While it did exist outside of the body, while they were tricked, while they were, bamboozled, they still had a personal responsibility. Because it don't just exist outside of the body, it also exists inside of the body. And you have to look at both. So let's look at inside the body. I'm going to read to you over in let's go to Ecclesiastes 9. We'll look at one quick thing here in Ecclesiastes 9. Let's go 9 and verse 3. Solomon writing here, he says, "This is an evil. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of the Son of Man are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live." Solomon pins it exactly where it's supposed to be, on our hearts. "I have seen an evil that exists under the sun. It's in the hearts of man." There is an evil outside, but there's also evil inside of us. We took of the fruit and we understand that good and evil is there. And Solomon pins it where it needs to be. We'll couple that. You don't have to turn there. I'll just quick quote it in Jeremiah 17, where he says, "The heart is deceitful and desperately wicked above all. Who can understand it?" In both of those places, neither Jeremiah or Solomon said evil exists in Satan alone. He's the instigator. He's the only one doing it. Both of the gentlemen are saying, hey, it's a heart problem. It's inside of us. We'll look over at Romans chapter 1. Let's turn over to Romans 1, verse 28. Romans 1 and verse 28, he says, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind, to do the things which are not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, sexual immorality, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, evil-mindedness. They are whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, violent, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, undiscerning, untrustworthy, unloving, unforgiving, unmerciful." look at this list, at no point, does Paul say, so God gave them over to the ruler of this world. He gave them over to a debased mind. Satan's not in this list. The outside evil influence is not in this list. Left on our own, mankind can do this to themselves. Before the fall of man, before the flood, what does he say? Evil was on their hearts continually, on their minds continually. That's all they thought about. At no point in the story of the flood do we address an outside evil influence. Do we address Satan? Is he punished? It specifically says that the heart, that the thought of every man was on evil continually. Because it's also inside of us. James 4 says, where do wars come from? Right? Where does wars and disputes come from? It comes from ourselves. Because we want and we lust. Right? But just like outside of the body, there's also a danger if all we do is look at inside of the body. If all we do is say, well, evil exists inside of me, then we can be like Luke Russell and say, I can't be forgiven. I can't be redeemed. And instead of having a scapegoat, now we say, well, I have failed and there's nothing anyone can do about it. Look how evil I am. There's a danger when we look at it either way specifically. We have to look at both. We have to understand that it exists outside of the body and it exists inside of the body. Because when we understand that, we can address both issues. We have to be able to address both. And God's plan of salvation, surprise, surprise, addresses both. God is not just removing Satan. He's not just removing sin. He's taking care of all of it. We're going to look at that in the fourth point. Will it always exist? So we're going to look back at both places. Let's look outside of the body. We'll go back to Genesis 3 and verse 15. Sorry, we're jumping around a lot today. Genesis 3 and verse 15. This is God talking to the serpent. He says in verse 15, he says, and I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. This is the first prophecy of Christ coming and dying for our sins. Now let's think about this for a moment. Mankind falls, and in the very first paragraph, God talks about how we're going to get out of it. How he's going to bring us out of it. The first glimpse into the plan of salvation is revealed to us in the ultimate defeat and root cause of evil outside of the body. Satan, you're going to lose. He tells us up front. Man has fallen. The outside evil will not be there forever. Let's look at 1 John 3 and verse 8. First John 3, verse 8. John writing here, he says, he who sins is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. For this purpose the Son of God was manifested, that he might destroy the works of the devil. Now we're going to keep that in mind, because it says here that Christ is destroying the works of the devil. And we're going to couple that with Hebrews 2. I'm going to go over to Hebrews 2. We're going to see a similar statement, Hebrews 2 and verse 14. It says, inasmuch as then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had power of death, that is the devil, and release those who through fear of death were made all their lifetime subject to bondage. Hebrews 2 says that he's going to be destroyed. 1 John says it's going to be destroyed. Both words, translated destroyed, are different. And John, the word for destroy is L-U-O, and it means to loose or dissolve or to release. The word for destroy here in Hebrews, katagro, it means to render impotent and abolish. Let's understand that Christ's death does two things. Two things. He destroys both the works of the devil and the devil himself. Complete. Outside of the body, in the future, will be fully gone. Not just the devil himself, the works of the devil and the devil himself. Christ's death has done that for us. We see that ultimately in the future in Revelation. Look at Revelation 20. You don't have to turn there again. This is very familiar. Verse 10, Revelation 20, the devil who had deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. In the future, God will fully remove the outside influence of evil. Will it always exist outside of the body? No. Because he's working out his plan of salvation to make sure that outside influence will no longer be there. What about inside the body? Turn over to Ezekiel 36. Look at Ezekiel 36. I'll just quote Ezekiel 36 in verse, let's go to verse 25. Then I will sprinkle clean water on you, and you shall be clean. I will cleanse you from all your filthiness and from all your idols. I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. And I will take the heart of stone out of your flesh and give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you will keep my judgments and do them. We've addressed the outside influence. Now when we start looking at the inside influence, remember Solomon pins it on our very hearts. And Ezekiel starts to reveal to us the way around that is to get a new heart and a new spirit. One that is not wicked, one that is not full of evil. A new heart, a new spirit that will lead us into understanding, that will guide us, as it says here, to keep his statutes and to keep his judgments and to do them. We'll look at Christ's own words in John. We'll go over to John 14, verse 25. John 14 and verse 25, Christ speaking, he says, these things I have spoken to you while being present with you, but the Helper, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring you into remembrance of all things that I have said to you. We're given a new spirit that helps us understand, that leads us into change. It's that change agent that we've needed to help us convert what we are to what we should be and what we will be in the future. We, at our very core, at our very basic human element, we are good and evil. We know the process. Remember, Genesis says they've become like one of us, knowing good and evil. We're given the Spirit to help us transcend from that, to change from that, to learn to be more like God the Father and Jesus Christ, to overcome those things. John 16, just turn over one page, John 16 and verse 13. Very similar, it says, however, when he, the Spirit of truth, has come, he will guide you into all truths. We get a new heart, we get a new spirit that helps lead us to understand how we are to live and what we are to do. What's it leading and helping us with? It's leading us to be like Jesus Christ. Remember Ephesians when it says, you know, we come to the fullness of Jesus Christ. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to become like him. And that Spirit is helping us get there. And it's leading us and it's guiding us. And we're making changes so that we can be more and more like him. Why is that important when it comes to evil? Why is it important for us to be like God the Father and Jesus Christ when it comes to evil? Let's look over James 1. Because this is kind of the linchpin here. James 1, verse 13. It says, "Let no one say to you when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted by evil." God cannot be tempted by evil. Ultimately, we are trying to become like Him, to change our very character, to be sons and daughters of God the Father, brothers and sisters with Jesus Christ, because both God the Father and Jesus Christ cannot be tempted by evil. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here, because we know that the outside evil influence will be destroyed, the inside evil influence will be destroyed, but will evil itself go away? Well, remember, Genesis 3, man has become like one of us to know good from evil. The idea of what evil is will never go away. What goes away is our ability to be tempted by it. God is eternal. He sees the beginning from the end. He understands where evil leads, what it does. It goes back to that choice. He has chosen to create us. We have chosen to follow Him. He chose to love us. We have chosen to love Him. He cannot be created, be tempted by evil. It doesn't say that evil doesn't exist, that the idea of evil is something that gets fully erased from our minds. He knows what it is. And by knowing what it is and fully understanding what love is, He cannot be tempted by it, and neither will we. Our desire to do evil things will go away, because we will be fully transformed to be like His Son. It's important for us to understand what evil is, where it exists, why we battle it. It's important for us to understand that the rest of this world is actively redefining evil and trying to teach young people that it doesn't exist. It's not real. Because if evil doesn't exist, you don't have to worry about moral law. You don't have to worry about the things you do being right or wrong. It all ties into fully rejecting God. They don't want anything to do with God. God, we've become like one of them, knowing good from evil. They're trying to reject everything possible that you could tie in to our Creator. Something that we have to be aware of. As more and more people are starting to preach this and teach this and go to our universities and say, "Hey guys, evil is not a real thing. It doesn't exist." We need to be aware of that. We have to understand what it is, where it is, and how ultimately we will get out of it.